I do a lot of work with organizations to help them decide what they're going to do next. And one of the things that I encounter over and over again is a phenomenon I refer to as because tradition. They have a lot of assumptions that guide most of the decisions they have already made and that will continue to guide their future decision making. Those assumptions can kind of calcify into these traditions that wind up creating a superframe for every piece of information they receive. They make it fit the tradition, the underlying assumption that is calcified to a point that it becomes a truism, a thing that is taken for granted. I meet a lot of organizations and decision makers who do things the way they do because tradition. So today I want to introduce you to someone who is doing the work of political science and polling in a way that pokes at tradition and interrogates assumptions in a way that really resonates with me as, I guess, a humanist and also as a qualitative researcher, someone who is not all that interested in using polls to predict, but rather uses polls to learn something. Some of what he has learned really calls on us to rethink what we thought we knew about our communities, our sense of patriotism, our sense of civic duty. I know I'm going to sound like an overeager first-year grad student here, and maybe that's more or less what I am, but I find as I encounter a lot of applied political theory in the United States electoral context, I wonder whether some of those theories aren't actually under-theorized. Lazy-ish assumptions that seemed right to everybody at the time and so became true because tradition. And I wonder if more applied political researchers and strategists ought to be looking to the work of people like today's guest and doing a lot more shoulder-to-the-wheel field work, investigating some of the first principles of politics, partisanship, voting, and so on. I think we're going to be on a bit of a series here of talking to people about how we question our own assumptions, revisit old ideas in politics, and de-emphasize what we can measure and predict to focus more on how to sense and respond to the real world we live in now. Just before I drop you into my conversation with Professor Ray Block Jr., today's guest, I want to just let you know one other thing. We've moved the Crosstabs newsletter to Substack. You can find it at crosstabspod.substack.com. We'll post there with new episodes, but also with analysis and updates based on recent polling, interesting studies in political science, and other public opinion data that tells us something about the world we live in. I hope you'll subscribe and tell a friend. In the meantime, if you are already a subscriber to the old newsletter, we will soon be moving you over. There's nothing you need to do. Anyway, that's it for housekeeping. Now on to the interview. So why don't we go ahead and start, and we'll just start with you introducing yourself and telling me a little bit about what you do.
I wear a few hats. I am at Penn State, and in my capacity as an employee at Penn State, I am the Brown McCourtney Career Development Professor and a faculty member in the Department of Political Science and the Department of African American Studies. All right. I'm also an employee at the RAND Corporation. And at the RAND Corporation, I am the Michael D. Rich Distinguished Chair for Countering Truth Decay. Everything that I do can be summarized as I study social identity and political involvement. Social identity can be a lot of stuff. It could be ethnicity and race and gender and sexuality, which are the things I typically focus on. But it could also be partisanship and political ideology. It could be geographic region. It could be ability. It could be a lot of things. Political involvement for me also can be a lot of stuff. It can be psychological in a sense that my dissertation was looking at people's interest in politics for how fascinated you are with what's going on in government. It could be trust in government. It could be whether you feel like you can make a difference. We call that political efficacy. It could be how knowledgeable you are about what's going on in politics. But I can also think about behavioral forms of political involvement, like voting, campaign contributions, contacting elected officials and community service, but it could also be protest activity as well. And I do a fair amount of research looking at both the psychological and behavioral components of political involvement and how social identity connects to that stuff. So that would be me in a nutshell.
It's a big nutshell. You've got to stay in shape just to be able to get your job titles out. How does one get to hold these two roles among all the other roles I'm sure that you play in your life? Tell me a little bit about your path so far. How did you get to here?
I would say there are accidents, but I won't say that because that takes away from the fact that I've been working really hard and people have put a lot of faith in me to do the things that I do. So, of course, I started out as a faculty member, but I've always been a faculty member who's concerned with issues of race and ethnicity and gender and sexuality. And so I've always attached myself, even though I'm a political scientist by training, to African-American studies departments, women and gender and sexuality studies departments, American studies departments, and like departments that really care about things related to social identity. As a political scientist, I have the luxury of studying things because I'm curious about them. But also, as a person who lives in this world thinking about politics and lives in this world thinking about politics as a Black person, I am very interested in how social identity plays a role in a lot of this stuff. And my affiliations with African American studies departments in particular really puts me in a position to think about how all of the knowledge that we have as faculty members can make a difference in society outside the university. So I spend a lot of time trying to figure out ways to combine my passions, which are the things that I study for a living, with my commitment to doing things that are going to be impactful to people that are not just audiences for the journals that I submit to and for people that are outside of my colleges and universities. And so I would say that passion, that tendency to want to do that kind of stuff, starts with all of the things that ended up following from it. And so what follows from it is I've had many opportunities to apply my interests to socially and publicly community important topics. That journey has led me to get a lot of information and experience from organizations like, for example, BSP Research, the African American Research Collaborative, the organization that I tend to be with. There are other organizations out there like it, like Sojourn Strategies and Hit Strategies. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these organizations to me are, I think, really important to this landscape because these are academics and analysts and policy wonks and community activists working together to figure out social problems. And I just really like applied research. I like applied research for that reason. And I like doing applied research because I think it's one of the ways that I can make a difference with the training that I have and with the temperament that I have. And so on that note, that baseline and a lot of these opportunities that just kind of happen to be things that pop up for me, which I'm very fortunate about, is the reason why you see me in this position where I have all of these hats that I wear. And again, I'm very fortunate to be able to wear all of these hats at the same time.
I found you ultimately through the African American Research Collective's website because, and I think when we spoke before, I mentioned this, that as I've been working on this project for all of 5 months, and people were making recommendations about who I should meet or talk to or who they'd like to hear from. You know, I'll admit, the first thing I noticed was that all the names I was getting were men. And the second thing I noticed was everybody I was getting recommended was white. In my own research practice, I have a fairly public to my clients commitment to not have more than 50% of our respondent pool ever be white. And so I was like, this is wild. Surely there are women and people of color engaged in polling and applied political science and applied social sciences. So, the Google machine helped me find African American Research Collaborative. And that's where I found you. Maybe you can talk a bit about that organization and what it does and why it's so needed.
I like to think of it this way. In the space where people care about what communities are interested in and what could be mobilizing for communities, everything that you said applies, right? So like there's a space that's open for folks that don't look like the categories of people that you just described, right? And there's a lot to learn about what's going on with communities of color when it comes to politics and society. Now, I come at this from the political science angle, so I'm especially interested in things related to voting and things related to candidate support and things that look at conversations between voters and politicians and how race and ethnicity play a big role in that kind of stuff, right? Gender as well. I would say that the African American Research Collaborative is one of several organizations out there that really focuses on that. And it's cultural competence meets rigor for polling and focus group research meets outreach. In other words, so like there are experts that are working on the team. All of us have a professional and personal interest in doing a good job when it comes to informing what we know about that stuff. And in addition to that, all of us are committed to talking to people who aren't always academics. And so like that work is really fulfilling in that regard. At the African American Research Collaborative, I've had the luxury of collaborating with organizations that I would probably never collaborate with if I were in academia by myself. And as someone who studied polling in graduate school and who worked in a polling place for a little while in graduate school, like, it's nice to be able to apply these trainings to something that's community centered. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the thing that sets organizations like ours apart is that the entire team is Black people. The clients typically are people in these communities as well. And the work that we do is designed to make sure that we can lift up messages that are normally part of the political dialogue. Mm-hmm. And so the African American Research Collaborative, to me, represents this evolution when it comes to community engaged polling and focus group research, because we do some qualitative research too. Mm-hmm. It's public facing, and at every step of the process is publicly engaging. And what that means is, we design instruments for people and communities that want certain things to be accomplished. They want to know, for example, what would be the best messaging to get people to get vaccinated? Or they want to know, why is it that housing, even though it's a major problem in our country, isn't something that's talked about as much at the state and local level, and especially at the national level by politicians, right? We intervene in those spaces by being informed by what people are doing in those spaces. Mm-hmm. We create instruments for them to help them to learn more about what their community needs are. And then we are very helpful when it comes of trying to figure out ways to communicate what those research findings are, not to an academic audience, but to an audience that may or may not have training in statistics, but that has a very vested interest in their communities getting better. And so I feel like those skill sets are really great because they mix research methods together with the study of race and ethnicity and politics, society. And they also provide an opportunity for people like me to be in touch with real folks who have real issues that they want real solutions to.
A thing that, you know, that I encounter when we ask sample providers for surveys, for example, to boost the sample size of African-American respondents, and in particular, this comes up with African-American respondents, is, oh, it's going to be really hard to find. And it never actually works out to be really hard to find. They make a lot of fuss about it, and then it's not a problem. But the thing that seems to happen as a result of that is, it, my sense of things as an observer, not someone who works in this space directly, is that at least with respect to public opinion polling, major news outlets, that kind of thing, that this winds up being a really understudied group in American civic life. And that it's, you know, weighted and sampled at proportion to population and those kinds of things. But if you have 1,000 people in a survey, you know what, that's 120, 130 people who are Black.
A little more
honored. Yeah. And so then you get into all kinds of other questions about, no single demographic is monolithic, and there are regional implications and class implications and all these other kinds of identities that come together. And so you've got a base size of 100, 130 at the most, and you got to split them up. And now you've got base sizes that are 10 and 20 and 50 people at most. And I'm just curious about, do you have a theory of why? What, you know, is it just that it's like, well, there's, it's only 12-13% of the population, so we don't have to work that hard for it? Is it some other kind of reason why we find such small base sizes of communities of color within national polling?
So I feel like it's getting better. I will say that. Well, yeah, I want to pile on, and we will pile on a fair amount. But
Let's talk about what's going right. Like, we can do that. We can start there.
Sampling is evolving in real time. And so, like, I remember when I first started out, folks were calling people on the phone.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, telephones were like the main mode by which we reached out to recruit people to be a part of these studies. We've moved to the point where we're very comfortable with online versions of these public opinion surveys. I would say that, I mean, I'm a political scientist by training, and my field, and you'll hear this from anybody you talk to that studies race and political science, the things that happen in the discipline reflect what happens in real life. And so the priority of thinking about what minorities care about and trying to understand what minority populations look like, that ebbs and flows. And there have been times when there was very little interest in that type of work. I would say that there's more interest in that type of work now than before. But if the priority for studying brown and Black folks was low, then it wouldn't be a surprise that there wouldn't be a lot of statistical innovations and a bunch of innovations in sampling and polling that would be set up to get at getting access to Black and brown folk. you know, I would say academic polling is more conscientious of that in political science, for sure. But in political science, what I've noticed is that these types of surveys, the ones that have hard to reach populations, it takes a while for them to get off the ground. And the people who are interested in that work have academic reasons for doing the work that they're doing. And that's lovely. I'm an academic, right? My organization and organizations like it, we have research questions for sure. And we will do intellectual work with the results that we get. But the interest in doing it doesn't stem from there primarily. We're interested in solving problems and getting current, up-to-the-minute information about what's happening in these communities. Once that information is created, the results can be a public good. And we're also very big on that, too. And so I would say there's a fair amount of territoriality in academia, and some things are paywalled or some things require a certain type of membership to get access to. We pride ourselves on creating stuff for clients. And once that stuff is created, when possible, we make it publicly available. And we'll do that in several ways. We'll disseminate it in like public facing outlets, like, you know, we'll write op-eds. We'll do media convenings. We'll have, for example, like these sort of public facing presentations about the work. And sometimes when we have resources to do so, we'll create interactive websites that people can access from anywhere. They can point and click and they can look at what the results look like broken down by certain populations. Not the same thing as doing in-depth statistical analyses, but a little bit closer than just giving people a PDF with a bunch of survey top lines and letting them, you know, make their conclusions from that, which we also do, right? But it's the idea that even in today's modern polling world, where academic work is more conscientious of the stuff that we're discussing, and where people are getting better at reaching hard-to-reach populations, there's still the idea that the timelines for academic research are just a little different. Like, you know, like it's very common for people in my field to be using polling data that's a year or two old, right?
Right.
For us, we're trying to be in the field multiple times in the same year, thinking about what information we can learn from communities and how that evolves over time. And there is a sacrifice that comes from doing work that is trying to be timely. It means that we're often after the fact thinking about things that could have been a part of the study. But the payoff is that we can intervene in real conversations about stuff that's happening in real time about politics. And we think that's a trade-off worth making.
It's a really interesting setup there of what a framework for thinking about different types of political polling is. Obviously, when you think about the New York Times Siena poll, the field dates are usually 3 to 5 days. Those are the shoulders of when the poll is in the field. They're doing them every other month or so. And, you know, they have their reasons for why they're doing their work. You know, it's a different model than what academics or public-facing organizations are doing that are not trying to, you know, I mean, candidly, get people to read their journalism, right? So it's a slightly different set of incentives there. But then you're absolutely right. There is the kind of slower burn stuff or the things that you're not going to refresh as frequently. And the difference there being like, how do you want to use this research? And this is something that I think about quite a bit, because in this, you know, election year, there's a lot of conversation about, are the polls broken or not? And all of the conversations I have with folks who are experts on this typically starts with a question of like, well, which kind of polls are we talking about? And I think it's interesting to think about, and maybe from here where I want to turn is ideas of civic engagement, because I think, you know, one of the, you know, people can think it's high-minded, but I actually, you know, generally agree with this. One of the purposes of opinion research in general is to give voice to people who are otherwise not active participants in a process. And so this is an important role for any kind of opinion research. I mean, in my side, like, it's often the only time my clients hear from their customers is when we go talk to them on their behalf. Maybe you can talk a bit about the role of opinion polling and start to move into some of your ideas about civic engagement and what the forms that are what forms of civic engagement people participate in, because I have a whole other topic I want to get into after that. But so I'll tee you up there.
Yeah. So my first thing I'll do is like, I hear it a lot. Like folks would just pile on about polling. Like, you can't trust the polls. You can't trust the polls. You can't trust the polls. And the very low hanging fruit response to that is you have to consider sample sizes and margins of error and stuff like that. Right. bigger than that, though, I'm just not in the prediction business. I'm not. And so, like, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about poll design and data collection from polling and dissemination of polling results for the sake of predicting who's going to win an election. That's just not it's not a natural tendency of mine. And I find it interesting because I think most people, when they think about the failings of polling, they're thinking about the failings of polling when it comes to making these types of predictions, you know. Outside of the prediction business, there's a whole lot that we can learn from public opinion polling. For example, in my field, there's a lot we can learn about racial differences and partisanship, especially given all of what we've seen recently. And it's a great run on research on partisanship and race and the fact that partisanship doesn't seem to have the same story around it for Black populations than it does for white populations. You know what I mean? So, like, what might be a subtle issue? Like, we normally assume, for example, that if you know someone's party identification, you know a lot about them politically. It seems like we don't know as much as we thought about partisanship once you factor in Black and brown folks into the equation, especially because political ideology doesn't connect to partisanship for Black people the way that it does for white people. What I mean by that is, for white folks, knowing someone's partisanship gives you a pretty good guess on what their political ideology is going to be. If they lean to the right in terms of their partisanship, you can predict that they lean to the right in terms of their ideology, right? And vice versa. It's hard to do with Black populations. If you know, for example, that somebody's a Democrat, you can't predict as well what their political ideology is going to be. Why? Because there are conservative Democrats and there are liberal Democrats, and there's this huge diversity of perspectives among Black populations, all crammed within the same political party for a number of reasons. Some people will say that's a pull reason, where the political motivations and recruiting among the Democrats has made it to where Black people feel more welcome there than they do in the Republican Party. Some people will say it's a push factor, where the unwelcomingness of the Republican Party produces a context by which many Black people find themselves in the Democratic Party in the contemporary context, right? Whatever the case, I don't think we would understand partisanship as well if we didn't think about race. I'll actually go a step further and say more boldly, I don't think we understand American politics very well unless we pay attention to what's going on with race. And the kind of work that we do at the African American Research Collaborative and my colleagues in organizations that focus on community-specific types of polling is going to help us to fill in those gaps in understanding.
Yeah. It turned out after I started Googling around and found you that I had been given a paper that you had worked on previously about the ideas of allegiance and belonging and how they influence civic participation. It had come up in a different context where, you know, candidly, after the 2016 election, one of my students, when I was teaching at Parsons, and I started working on a project together that was about, you know, what are the building blocks of civic involvement, and not, you know, getting beyond engagement, probably because I work in a field where everyone talks about engagement and no one knows what it means. And so, like, broadening it out a little bit and trying to take a look at, you know, what is it? How has it been defined up to this point? And so your work on allegiance and belonging was something that someone had shared with me. Gosh, I don't know. What are we now? It's 8 years ago.
It's
7 years ago, something like that. And so maybe you can talk a bit about what you found about those ideas, because I think the way that allegiance and belonging shows up for communities of color is different than the way it shows up for white folks.
So when we first started the project, one of the analogies is that, like, when you think about being an American, you know, like, what comes to mind, right? I've said this 1,000 times, so it's not like it's new. I like it, so I'm going to say it again here, right?
Okay.
So there's a way of thinking about Americanness where it's marching band music. You know, like, it's like a John Philip Sousa number, and, like, you know, there are drums and there are brass instruments, and there's all of this really triumphant stuff, right? For some people, that's how you think of America. For Black folks in particular, though, I think that if you ask people what America sounds like, if you want to think of it that way, it's a jazz number with blue notes. In the sense that some of the stuff isn't necessarily pleasant to hear because it doesn't seem to fit. But you have to have all of that in order to have the quality of the music that you get when you're listening to jazz, right? So in a world where we're thinking about blue notes instead of John Philip Sousa numbers, that world suggests that being an American a bunch of stuff to it. Like, there's the idea that you have to feel like there's a part of you that belongs to the country. And that sense of belonging might not be universal across all Americans, right? In other words, some Americans might feel like they belong more than other Americans. They either feel that because of, like, internal things, or because something about their experiences in the country has led them to believe that they either belong more or belong less. And those feelings, as complex as they are, they sit side by side with that allegiance stuff, we call it, right? The, what I want to call, love for the country. Mm-hmm. And this idea that feeling that love is really important to what American identity is. But we also believe that what's also important to American identity is the extent to which you feel like you belong to the country. And we feel like the combination of that love and belongingness, that combination is really important to producing civic action. So much so that depending on how high or low your sense of belonging is, when considered with your sense of allegiance, it might inspire a person to be more inclined to do what I'm going to call mainstream political activities versus non-mainstream political activities. In other words, if you feel like you belong a lot and you feel like the country loves you a lot, then mainstream stuff makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to do stuff that's inside of the system because you feel like inside of the system, things will work for you. If you don't feel like you belong very much, however, and you have varying levels of love for the country, you might do things that are a little more underground, more community focused, more outside of the system, because those things make sense for you in terms of the experiences that you had. I think generally speaking, this is what we were trying to get at when we did that study. Mm-hmm. By the way, shout out to Stacey Green and Nyambi Carter and Gabrielle Gray on that. These are other people that if you get a chance to reach out to, you should check them out as well.
You've already put me onto so many good people that I'm not going to turn down another recommendation from you. This is interesting in a few ways. One is it has echoes of that idea of, you know, sort of, I guess, colloquially gets expressed as, I love the country, but it doesn't love me back.
Love me back.
Yeah. And that's interesting to separate them out as deeply interlinked, but not necessarily the same things. That allegiance and belonging, allegiance is the loving the country, the belonging is it loving me back, and how that might influence what you choose to do, whether you choose to do it. The other thing that it makes me think about is the ladder of engagement metaphor and how, you know, my understanding of the original, I think it was Arnstein's ladder, is there's a beautiful kind of cynicism baked into her ladder. That's like understanding that there's kind of a threshold that elites would rather you don't cross, and like a kind of symbolic participation, like very consentful participation that they're comfortable with. And then, like, unless you kind of, again, kind of join the system, like unless you're like now going to run for office and sit at the same tables they sit at, the kind of protest, agitation, demand making, anything like that is resisted. And yet I think what's kind of happened with the metaphor over time, I remember, again, back around 2016, I think Google actually had done a study about civic participation, and they had used the ladder metaphor as a way of understanding people's commitments. And it winds up being a scale for, I don't know, judging, evaluating people's civic commitments. Like, well, people say they care a lot about politics, but they're not very far up the rungs of the ladder. And it's interesting that even apparently people in their study understood it as some sort of leveling up game. And so maybe you can talk about how you think about this. Is it a ladder? Is it a leveling up? How does it express itself when you're trying to navigate these waters of belonging and allegiance? Because, you know, you have to have a certain amount of trust to participate in something. And so I'm just curious what you make of that.
So I mean, so I feel like I'm just going to miss over a whole bunch of, like, so I'm putting a blanket apology to all the authors that won't say their names about this kind of work, right? So to me, the ladder metaphor, to me, suggests what I'm going to call more of a longitudinal setup. Now, it doesn't necessarily, like, I'm not saying the authors are putting time into this, but this is the way I think about it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if a person is active in one way at one point in time, the suggestion is that perhaps future forms of activism can be dependent on, or maybe they'll transition from one form of activism to another. Like, in other words, like, one form of political activity might be the gateway drug to other forms of political activity. And then there's an institutional response to that rationing up of political activism and stuff like that, right?
Right.
There's a version of that story that moves in the opposite direction, where like there's this fatigue that can occur. And we see this in some of the qualitative research with the people that we're interviewing and doing polls for, where depending on communities to be civically active, and then returning to those communities for future elections to be civically active, where there isn't a sense among the members of that community that promises were made the first time around, makes it to where even though this is a group of people that are very civically minded and have a reputation for being civically active because of their past record, still guarantee that these folks are going to be either more civically active in different ways or more civically active in the ways they typically use because of this fatigue that can start to accumulate, right? There are authors that write about this. Sally Nuama has a really good piece about this. Another way that I think about this latter thing is that, again, thinking about Black and brown folk, right? That idea that protesting is somehow anti-system is something that I've always been fascinated about. I feel like in political science, there's this hate made for protest research nowadays, obviously connected to Black Lives Matter. But beyond that, like we're spending more time than we ever did as political scientists thinking about protest activity as an important form of civic activism. We know logically that it is. But for whatever reason, there was a tendency in the literature on civic activism to focus more on inside the system stuff and to be a little hesitant to think about protest activity as anything more than the aggregated outward expression of negativity towards the system. And another colleague of mine, this is Legina Gauss at UC San Diego, wrote a book recently that talks about how rational protest is and how effective protesting is as a way of pushing change along. Like sociologists who study social movements all over this stuff, political scientists are weighing in, contributing their scientific approaches to thinking about this. And the people who study race and ethnic politics are weighing in on this and showing real case study work on how effective protest activity can be, not only because it can create governmental change, but also because it can change conversations that are happening among leaders. And those changes in conversation can have real policy implications to them as well.
I mean, it is interesting to think about, because I think the original ladders that were constructed, and this is happening in the late 60s, they don't even have protest on them. By the time Google is doing their study in 2015, 2016, whenever it was actually just underneath organizing as like top of the ladder activities. And it you know, we are once again in a season of protest. And once again, we have these conversations about like slicing and dicing what legitimate forms of protest are versus illegitimate forms of protest when, I mean, I don't know, I'm old enough to know that there's not like a hard line delineation between these things. We've seen enough of these to know that like it's all kind of happening simultaneously. And also like, what do you mean legitimate? I was listening to something the other day where they were talking about Jerry Rubin becoming a stock trader, right? Here he is, one of the merry pranksters, you know, the Chicago Seven, and then he becomes a stock trader. But a lot of people who were involved in 60s peace protests, frankly, became things like social workers, teachers, you know, working in public policy, working in local government. And so they didn't all become yuppies, you know what I mean? But they didn't all stay in the protest movement. There were other things that they did with their experiences and their ideas and the things that they wanted to change about the world around them. And it is just interesting to think about, it's not this linear progression. And it's also then interesting to think about the difference between a kind of individuated version of civic participation and a more interactive communal experience of it, that it's not all about measuring you, the individual, and your level of engagement. Right. You know, I think you've done some thinking about this, and I'm curious what you think about these kind of individualistic versus more kind of collectivistic approaches to civic participation.
Yeah, and you said the magic word when you said organizing. And so, again, I'm name dropping, but Hari Han, Diva Whitley was a great scholar and colleague. Hari Yaz, Hari Tun, Dan Galvin, and folks like that who spend time thinking about this, the way that community organizers think about this, And actually talking to community organizers to think about how they set things up, right? There's a lot that we can learn in political science from talking to people who are in these struggles and who do this work, not because they're trying to get published, but because they want to get some kind of positive change to happen in their communities, you know?
Right.
And it's interesting, again, how little of that is reflected in mainstream understandings of how politics works. And it's really funny to me because, like, without organizing, you don't get a lot of the other stuff. So if voting is an individual action, voter drives and registration drives contribute to that. Those things require people on the ground to be very conscientious about how to recruit people and how to inspire people, how to reassure people, and how to bring people to the place to where they feel like it's worth it to put in that energy to do the kind of things that would have a political impact, right? So there are lots of folks like me and my colleagues who study organizing, want to figure out ways to make the study of organizing more obvious to political scientists and other social scientists. So much so that we have an organization that we created. It's a form of collective action and organizing that meets from time to time. We lift up each other's research. We have like these brainstorming sessions and we basically inspire together to think about ways that we can bring a true sensitivity to organizing to the study of politics. I got there because of my public facing work. And the public facing work that we were doing with the African American Research Collaborative sort of put us in a position to talk to community organizers and to ask questions and to do things that was reflective of their missions. Later on, I started to really care about the work. And now I'm doing this work where I'm thinking about how community organizers conceive of and execute the things that they think are important and how the study of politics in a more scientific sense can contribute to that. But what that also means is that we look very hard as political scientists at the real life and practical things that organizers are doing so that they can accomplish those goals, because there's a very rich tradition of things that work and things that don't that need to inform what the eggheads are doing. And maybe the eggheads can be in better conversation with the activists. And I think the space between eggheads and activists should be closed, partly because of my own personal passion for this stuff, but also because there's all of this opportunity there to just get really good about this stuff. So like, if problem solving is something folks care about, being better connected with the people that are, you know, enduring the problems is just a good idea. Being better about how well our theories fit our analyses, be they qualitative or quantitative, is just a good idea. Yeah. And having more people that are interested in doing this kind of work means that more problems will get addressed ultimately down the road.
So this is also interesting to me in light of some of the surveys that have been done by news organizations about the protests on campuses, and that the focus of those is often very much the percentage of people who agree with the aims of the protesters to the extent that they know what they are, and the people who disagree, you know, or who are neutral about it, who think that the protests should be allowed to continue, who don't, who are in favor of calling the cops or not. But it's never really a reckoning with what's happening. It strikes me. It's this kind of asking the observers what they make of what they see, as opposed to asking the protesters what they are experiencing and what their aims are or anything else. And it's been a kind of convenient narrative for a long time, I think, of either being overly reductive about the demands of a particular protest movement. I think, you know, they did a very effective job with the Black Lives Matter movement of condensing it in some communities down to defunding the police when there's a lot more going on than that. And that phrase didn't necessarily mean what people thought it meant. But the other side of it that I think about with Occupy was a kind of steady narrative that there was no leadership and no clear set of demands. And we've seen that repeated again with these campus protests of, you know, there's no clear set of demands. What do they even want? And so then it becomes very easy to just sort of dismiss them over kind of silly things. But The number of people who have mentioned to me students ordering Grubhub to the Columbia campus, but not anything substantive that the protesters are asking for, is a little bit shocking to me, I think. But in any event, that is an interesting place to start to do more study of, is the actual movement itself, the actual organizing, the actual aims of the protest, and the reasons people would engage in it, as opposed to just like, all right, folks at home, what do you think? Up or down? Right.
And I would go a step further. So in addition to the fact that we need to be talking more to the people on the ground, I actually think there's a place for looking at reactions to protests. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to do it, don't do it superficially. Like, go all the way in and understand, for example, why is it that there are moves now to make protesting illegal?
Yes.
In the context where the protests happen to involve certain groups of people. And in other contexts, for example, other groups of people are not viewed in a context where the conversation about the legality of protests happen. So I feel like mm-hmm. there's space to talk about what's going on the ground and to like actually learn from people on the ground about what's going on with the protest activity. But the what I'm going to call elite response to protest and how social identity plays a huge role in what responses are deemed legitimate and what isn't, I think is a worthy line of research if people want to be honest about that line of research mm-hmm. and unafraid of what they learn when they start doing that line of research.
That makes me think about the whole concept of elite panic, right? That in crisis moments, people don't actually riot and loot. They generally help their neighbors out, but the elites freak out. The elites are worried. So they start, you know, protecting the storefronts instead of helping each other out. This is, I think, is an interesting through line earlier today. I was interviewing someone else and we were just talking about the stakes versus the odds, as Jay Rosen talks about it. And getting into that exploration is really important. I know you have to run. There's a million other things I'd love to talk to you about. Maybe we can do this again and we can talk about truth decay, because I would love to do that.
Awesome. Yeah, basically the answer is yes. Let's do another one of these very soon, actually.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe and find out immediately when new episodes drop. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, drop us a note if you have any questions about poll design or sampling or weighting or anything else, and we'll see you next time.